Rourke noticed the growing glow of bright light from the corner of his eyes, instantly realizing everything he needed to know. It was positioned across the thick, dark slash carved by the Mississippi through the landscape below.
Everyone, look away from the windows! Put your heads down! Protect your faces and your eyes!
Rourke looked into the aisle at the stewardess who had helped him with the older woman earlier came down the aisle. Her hands reached out to the seats to steady herself against the jet's motion. Her face was white, her eyes wide. Rourke reached out and took her hand, leaning across the man next to him as he did.
What is it? You just came from the captain.
Nothing, Mr. Rourke. Nothing to worry.
Rourke produced a business card and showed it to her.
You know what this card is?
It says Central Intelligence.
Yeah. Now, unless your passenger list shows somebody else, I'm the closest thing to a government official you've got on this plane. Now, what's up? Pilot and co-pilot were blinded, weren't they?
How did you...
It only makes sense. They couldn't have looked away from the St. Louis blast in time. There's too much glass up there anyway. Did the cabin keep its integrity? None of the glass was broken or anything?
Yes, but you're right. Neither of them can see. It's on autopilot now, but with this turbulence...
Yeah, exactly. Give me the microphone for the speaker system.
Follow me.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Rourke. I am a special employee of the government.
What did he say?
Now, I want everybody to be quiet a minute and listen. First, haul down the shades on the windows and don't look outside. Second, if you got someone seated near you who appears to be having trouble with his eyes right now, that will hopefully be just temporary. After I'm through talking, get a pillow from the compartment above your seat and try to make that person comfortable. I'm also a qualified physician, so I'll be coming around to check on you all. Take a blanket from the compartment and try to keep the injured person warm. Soon we will come to you and make available whatever medical assistance is required. Ladies and gentlemen, it looks like the United States is under a nuclear attack. Now let's be quiet and let's keep calm. I wish I could say something encouraging about what's going on below us on the ground, but I can't. But for now, we are all reasonably safe. Now, I'd like anyone with flight training of any sort to report to the front of the forward cabin as soon as I'm through talking. Do not panic. The captain has the plane under control, but because of the turbulence from the heat on the ground, he can use some extra help on some of the instruments. Also, anyone with any sort of first aid training or nursing experience, report up here as well. Now, we'll need your help to get everyone comfortable and start tending to their medical needs. The flight attendants will come around now with complimentary drinks. I suggest you have one. It's going to be a long night, folks.
Okay, let's crowd into the galley. Talk things over. You too, miss. Miss, I need you to close the curtains. Keep them closed. It'll keep the crowd from panicking if they see any fire and decrease the risk of anyone else getting blinded by another blast. Now, does anyone here have any kind of flight training?
I do.
What kind of training?
I started private pilot training 3 weeks ago. I've had 4 lessons in the air, that's all.
Well, that's better than nothing, isn't it? Anybody else? Then I assume the rest of you have had some medical training. Now, the flight attendant here will coordinate with you on anything you need. Anybody a nurse? All right. The stewardess is going to get on the PA system and see who among the passengers has aspirin or any other kind of painkillers. Lay off the aspirin unless nothing else is available. You might find that some of these people have radiation sickness, and the last thing they need is something else to irritate their stomachs. Flush the burned areas on their faces and eyes. Use cold compresses. Try to make everyone comfortable. Do what you can. I'm a doctor, so if you need any advice, have the flight attendant check with me. Now, I don't have a bag or any instruments or drugs or anything else, but I can help. Now, miss... What's your name?
It's Mrs. Amanda Richards.
Well, Mrs. Richards, you and I are going to go forward and see about helping the captain and the co-pilot, okay?
I don't know how much help I can be, Mr. Rourke.
Call me John. It's simpler. We'll help however we can.
Another flight attendant and the 5 passengers who'd claimed some medical experience had already started down the aisle with towels and large containers of water.
Forgive me for going ahead of you, Mrs. Richards. Shut the door, Mrs. Richards.
My God, both of these men are blind.
That's why we're here, Mrs. Richards. But if we tell all the passengers, they might panic. And that wouldn't do anyone any good, right?
Who are you?
My name is John Rourke, Captain. I'm one of the passengers. The flight attendant told me you might need some help.
You're the doc, aren't you?
Yeah, well, in a manner of speaking. But I'm here to help you. I've tested out on military jet fighters, flown a helicopter. And there's a woman here with me, Mrs. Richards, who's had flying experience too. Thought maybe we could give you a hand. Now, if you can stay conscious, maybe you can tell us what to do to keep this thing airborne and help us land it when it's time.
That's impossible, Doc. The controls on these babies are just too much unless you know them. I can't talk you through it.
Well, you better give it the best try you can. Now, by the looks of that fuel gauge, I don't figure we've got more than a couple of hours flying time before we hit empty. An autopilot isn't going to do much next time we hit a shockwave from a missile going off under us.
What's the use? We're all dead anyway.
Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. But we can't just commit suicide up here, can we?
It's no good. But go ahead and try if you want.
I will. Mrs. Richards, see if you can help make these guys comfortable. But start with the captain first. The co-pilot's pretty far gone. Are there any manuals, instruction booklets, anything that can help me with this thing?
The pilots have manuals, but they're designed as troubleshooting references. I don't know if they'd be of any help.
Well, what we're about to do, I guess you could call it troubleshooting.
My wife, the children.
They're fine, Mr. President. We'll be perfectly safe here.
Is everyone here at Mount Lincoln?
Your chief of staff, Paul Dorian, is here, sir. Mr. Thorpe is here. Lieutenant Brightston is playing with your youngest son, running movies for him. Rear Admiral Corbin and his intelligence people made it.
What about Secretary Meeker?
As far as we can determine, he was going to get his wife, and we don't think he made it. Washington is all but gone. Vice President Sneed didn't make it either, sir. They couldn't get him out of the hospital at Bethesda in time. The operation he was having was at the critical stage.
My God, Meeker. Sneed. How many millions, Potter? Any estimate yet? Yes, come in. Yes, Admiral.
Mr. President, I've got a preliminary situation report.
What about casualties?
Well, it's too early to tell, Mr. President. It looks like they made a massive launch. But with the exception of a few strategically important cities, primary concentration was on our military targets, not on population centers. Some reports from the Midwest indicate that neutron devices may have been used, so the real estate up that way should at least be salvageable.
What sort of damage are we inflicting on them?
Major cities, major industrial complexes. They got way too much of our stuff while it was on the ground. I think we lost this one, sir.
This one? Admiral Corbin, don't you realize there isn't going to be another one?
All right, children. I think we can see what's going on now.
Doesn't.
What's wrong with the radio, Mom? I think the ground shaking must have loosened a wire inside it. You know, these radios are made up of thousands of wires. Your father can tell you about it better than I can.
Where's Daddy, Mommy?
Oh, he's coming, honey.
It'll be all right, Anne.
Michael, you stay here with Anne for a minute. I'm going upstairs to look around.
Can we come? We don't want to stay here.
All right. But stay behind me, just in case anything is wrong upstairs. Michael, go back and very gently pick up the water jugs. Hurry, but be careful.
But can't we get the water later, Mom?
No, son. I don't know if we'll come back down here again. I smell gas and we might be risking a fire. Don't touch anything metal. Don't scrape against anything at all if you can help it. And come back and hold your sister's hand. Now, Michael, don't let go of her. No matter what you do, do you understand?
Yes, Mommy. But why?
Never mind. Just follow me, Michael.
Will you pick me up, Mommy?
I can't now, Annie. But I will later.
I want someone to carry me.
You're going to have to walk, Annie.
As they entered the house, Sarah drooped her head in relief. The smell of gas was completely gone. As she looked up and down the hallway, she could see that apparently every window in the house had smashed inward. The rooms were littered with glass from broken dishes and vases. The overhead lights, everything was destroyed.
What happened, Mommy?
Some
Some very bad men dropped some big bombs on our country, Michael. You've heard about the atomic bomb? The hydrogen bomb? Well, they have a lot more explosive force than ordinary bombs. All this mess is from bombs they dropped on Atlanta. And you know it takes us an hour and a half to drive there. So Atlanta is pretty far away. I want us to get a few things and get out of the house. We'll stay in the barn tonight.
Why would we stay in the barn, Mom?
Mommy, I don't like the barn very much.
Because of the gas that we all smelled down in the cellar. Gas could still build up and explode. We'll be safer in the barn. Now, come and help me. We're going upstairs to get a few clothes and things, just in case we don't get back to the house for a while. Michael, take some jeans, underpants, a couple of shirts, all your socks and two extra pairs of shoes, and put them in your backpack. Then get Annie started. Take your sweaters, too.
It's not very cold out, Mom.
Michael, you're very smart, and sometimes you're very grown up. But sometimes I need you to do what I say. Exactly what I say. Now hurry and do it. And don't forget to start getting Annie packed, too. Watch out for broken glass, Annie. Stay with Michael.
Sarah walked to the end of the hall from the bedroom she shared with her husband when he was home. She went to his dresser. She looked down at the object in her hands, reading the words emblazoned on the side. Colt's Government Model MK4 Series 70. Then underneath that, caliber 45 ACP. As she held the gun, she wished she'd listened to her husband more attentively when he'd told her about it. She remembered his leaving it there several months earlier. Sarah had gotten that discussion over with as quickly as possible. Now she turned the gun over in her hand. It had rubber grips, black, with medallions of tiny horses on them. Shrugging her shoulders, she stuck the gun in the waistband of her blue jeans, shivering a little because the metal was cold against her skin. In the same drawer, she found two extra clips, which her husband had always told her were magazines. She took those and a box of ammunition and stuffed them into a large canvas purse, then went into her own dresser and got underwear, some t-shirts, and two sweaters. She also took two pairs of jeans, identical to the ones she wore. She put two pairs of track shoes into the huge canvas bag as well, then went back to her husband's dresser and took as many pairs of his white sweat socks as she could fit into the case. She snatched up their wedding picture, too, stripped it from the frame, and folded it in fourths, then put it into an inside pocket of the bag. As she passed the bathroom, she took a canvas bag from under the sink, an old U.S. mail bag, and began stuffing it with soap, tampons, toothpaste, band-aids, and disinfectant spray. Back downstairs with the children, Sarah had carried everything into the kitchen. Her husband had insisted on her keeping a supply of freeze-dried foods from Mountain House and similar items, all in a large duffel bag in the pantry. She grabbed this up, opened the bag, and stuffed a few cans of soup and beans and a can opener inside it as well. She thought of one other thing. She wrapped the very sharp Henkel's boning knife in a kitchen towel and slipped it into the duffel bag. She could barely move the bag.
Come on, children!
We're ready, Mom.
Wait one second.
Sarah went over to the mantle, grabbed the pictures of the children, and stripped them from their frames. Then she took the double-barreled shotgun from over the hearth and grabbed the box of shotgun shells from the drawer in the small end table.
Okay, this is going to be quite an adventure.
She opened the front door and they stepped out onto the porch.
Mommy? What's that orange light?
It's Atlanta, Michael. Come on, children. Let's get to the barn.
Come in. You have the figures I requested, Potter.
Indeed, Mr. President.
How accurate are they?
Well, they're computer estimates based on intelligence data. Close.
All right. Tell me.
Less than 20% of continental land-based missiles were able to get airborne. Of the ground bombers, approximately 85% made it out. Our nuclear submarine fleet and bombers holding at the failsafe point came out okay in terms of doing their job. I have a ratio of 90% effectiveness for the submarine fleet. The bombers got to target, but apparently that Soviet particle beam system knocked most of them out.
I want to know about casualties. Us and them.
We estimate 60% of the U.S. population dead or dying. About 145 million people.
Oh, sweet Jesus.
By morning, there should be at least 75 times more third-degree burn patients than all pre-war burn centers and fully equipped hospitals could handle. The anticipated deaths as a consequence make up part of that 145 million casualty figure. Add another 20% for residual deaths from radiation poisoning. So we get slightly less than 175 million dead within the next few weeks, and that should be the maximum figure. I can go into greater depth, Mr. President. We have a preliminary statistical breakdown.
Later, Thurston. How did the Russians do?
We knocked out 60% of their heavy industry, approximately 40% of their population, and they still got the Chinese to contend with. Other global casualty figures aren't too complete yet, but much of the British Isles have been destroyed, some major cities in Canada. Most of France is intact. Nothing nuclear except for a lot of tactical stuff used in West Germany, and Soviet divisions are swamping Europe. But that won't last. The Chinese are really giving the Russians hell on the Sino-Soviet border.
How about our forces?
That's not so good, Mr. President. Our European land forces have been pretty much wiped out. But a lot of small units are still fighting independently, and the Pentagon people indicate they'll go on doing that until you tell them otherwise. Most military bases in the continental United States were knocked out, since they were A-class targets because of their missiles. The really bad news is an unconfirmed report that when the missiles struck on the West Coast, they ruptured the San Andreas Fault Line and caused massive earthquakes and tidal waves. We've confirmed that New York City was swamped by an Atlantic tidal wave. Estimated casualty figures don't include the San Andreas quakes, but do include the New York disaster.
Are the Russians coming?
The determination is they'll make landings in certain safe cities where they used neutron bombs.
How long?
About 24 hours. It's more symbolic than military. They can hold those areas, but just frankly don't have the manpower to do anything else with the Chinese on their rear ends. And they won't have sufficient heavy industry for years to get up enough muscle to actually occupy our entire country. We've got some small independent military units that are ready to go and make the Soviet occupation here miserable. Should be able to keep up fighting almost indefinitely.
I suppose I should be thankful. The whole planet could have been blown out of its orbit and plunged into the sun, like some of the scientists have been warning.
Well, sir, no one got to use all their stuff. The Russians have pretty much stopped targeting us now. May have been a slight axis shift. Could result in some radical climatic changes. Can't tell yet. Pretty scary business. Mind if I sit down, Mr. President?
Oh, I'm sorry, Thurston. Yes, go ahead and sit.
Mr. President, what are you going to do?
I was afraid somebody was going to ask me that. Well, I have no precedent to guide me. The country, more or less, has ceased to exist. I don't know. What about fallout? Any guesses there?
Well, sir, we had a lot of scenarios worked out for war, and this one comes closest to scenario 18A. I doubt you'd remember it by that number, but basically, it looks as though the fallout should stay in bands across the country, and when it settles to the ground, stay that way. Some areas will become nuclear deserts, and are estimated to remain that way for perhaps hundreds of years, depending on the exact nature of the warheads the Soviets dropped. Some few areas will have very little danger from fallout, but then, of course, almost the whole Mississippi basin was destroyed with direct hits. So the entire midsection of the country is going to be a vast no-man's land for a century or more.
The planet isn't dead, though.
Not as far as we can tell. I don't know if I should tell you what Rear Admiral Corbin said.
Tell me.
Well, he called it instant urban renewal. Said someday future generations may actually thank us for this. Only the really fit will survive. The weaker types will be naturally cropped out. The land will eventually restore itself.
He's full of crap.
The Soviet premier signed the necessary papers for the token airborne invasion of several neutron-bombed cities. Most important would be Chicago, or what was left of Chicago after the Seiche in Lake Michigan had produced a tidal wave effect and destroyed much of the city proper. Chicago was the largest of the cities they would occupy. Atlanta, St. Louis, Washington, and other eastern cities had been destroyed by conventional nuclear weapons and would be uninhabitable for, he checked the figures on the radioactive half-life of the nuclear material, 204 years. Los Angeles and other western cities were not to be considered. Los Angeles, San Francisco, and most of Central California had fallen into the Pacific, where the San Andreas fault line had slipped. This distressed the premier. Tidal wave effects had swamped a portion of western Canada. Parts of Alaska were expected to slide toward the coastal areas of Siberia and eventually Japan. This desk lamp, unlike the one in his Kremlin office, was strong and it hurt his eyes. Sitting in the darkness, secure in his bomb shelter, he recalled the preliminary casualty estimates for the Soviet Union, some 40% of the overall population. He closed his eyes. 120 million men and women and children were dead. And there was still the war with China. In the darkness, where no one could see him, he brushed tears from his great dark eyes.
You're right, Mr. Rourke. The captain is dead.
Looks like it's up to us now.
I guess you're right.
From what I've been able to tell, we've got about 2 hours of flying time left. Less, since we'll need some fuel to get her down. And we'll have to get down to a lower altitude before we can do that.
This is Buck Anderson, camp operator out of Tombstone, Arizona. Captain, over.
I hear someone, Mrs. Richards. Take the co-pilot's headset. This is Can-American 747, flight 601. Reading you is some heavy static. Do you read me? Over.
This is Buck Anderson, ham operator out of Tombstone, Arizona. Captain, over.
I'm no captain, just a fellow flying the plane. Captain and co-pilot bought it with flash burns. Is it possible for you to relay our signal and get us some professional help, maybe from Tucson?
There is no Tucson.
Buck, you still reading me? Over.
I'm still reading you, but there is no Tucson. Everything to the west has either gone into the sea like California did, or been flooded. We're on an island out here now.
Yeah, I knew your area. Was there for El Dorado days.
But the water, it may be rising. Not sure if it stopped. Everyone is dead. I'm sick. The bombs that hit Tucson and Phoenix just wiped them out. As far down as Benson.
What's your source for the West Coast thing? Over.
Ham operator, a girl I knew. We were on when the bomb started falling, and she kept on. Somehow I was still getting her. Then she started describing it. Horrible.
Tell me. Over.
Oh, mother of God. The building started shaking. The ground. From where she was, she could see the ground starting to open. And then she went off. After that, I picked up another commercial flight. Told me they were watching from the air. Huge cracks in the ground. Lava coming up. Then suddenly it all slipped away. And there was a giant wall of water. I lost the transmission after that. The pilot said the turbulence was getting bad and cut off.
Any word on Flagstaff, Buck? Over.
No. Nothing since the civil defense broadcast over an hour ago. The whole area around Flagstaff and the Grand Canyon had an 8 or 9 point earthquake, and there were bombs still falling.
Buck, you gonna make it? Over.
I don't think so. I'm starting to throw up blood. Vision is already blurry. I think it's radiation sickness.
It is, Buck. Over.
That's what I thought.
I'm sorry.
I wish I could help you get your plane down, but I can't. Maybe you're better off crashing. It's hell down here. Air is bad. Water's rising now. I can tell. And
Buck?
My generator handle pulled out. Sorry.
Anything on New Mexico? Over.
Did he die?
No, Mrs. Richards. We just got into different airspace and out of his frequency. No, he didn't die. Yet.
Maybe the boy was right.
Look, as long as we're alive, we've got a chance. Once we give up and lie down, that's it.
My husband was in California.
I have a wife and 2 children back in Georgia.
But they could still be alive. I know my husband is dead. Maybe that boy was just a liar. A liar! He was just lying because he didn't know. It couldn't have just fallen
into... I don't think he was lying, Mrs. Richards.
Do you think my husband could have survived?
Honestly?
Yes.
No. No, I don't. Even if he was on the right side of the fault line, the tidal wave would have gotten him. I had a friend in San Diego. Told me once that if the San Andreas Fault ever went, he'd be okay. His office and his house were on the continental side. I didn't have the heart to remind him about the tidal wave. You see, when those mountains slipped off and all the land on the other side, the impact and the added mass, as well as the slipping motion itself, all that figured in to create a tsunami and then flood the lowland. I don't know where the new coastline will wind up.
Why should I live? There's nothing left. Nothing to live for. Why live now?
That's a question you're going to have to answer for yourself, ma'am. And I hope you can. Now, let's try to fly this plane and get everyone down, huh?
Maybe you just said it. We got all those people back there, haven't we?
Yes, we have. And all they've got right now is us.
What will it be like on the ground? If we make it, I mean.
Well, your guess is as good as mine. But I don't see humanity coming to a screeching halt, if that's what you mean. Maybe civilization. But humanity? Humanity will find a way of going on. It always has. And it always will. Now, like the man said, let's see if this mother will fly. You got charge of the instruction.
Mr. Rock!
That wasn't me, lady. That was the explosion down there. Hit that seatbelt sign, Mrs. Richards, and get on the PA and tell everyone to settle in. I gotta climb before that blast cooks us.
Was that another missile that hit?
No. We were over an oil refinery, is my guess. It just blew. Now, hit that seatbelt sign, huh?
Sarah Rourke, crouched by the inside of the barn door, her right hand clutching the shotgun, her left arm around both children. Four men and a woman were the object of her gaze. All were in their middle or late 20s, it looked. They stood around a late-model van with a smashed right front fender. They had guns in their hands. She recognized one of them, a military-type weapon, an M16, she thought. It looked similar to a gun her husband used a lot, but the rear portion of the stock was different.
Who is it, Mommy?
Shh, Michael.
Hello in the house!
Mommy, she said hello to our house.
Shh. Hey, who's in the barn? I said, who's in the barn?
I am.
Just who are you?
I'm a woman with a gun, mister. Come any closer and you'll find out who I am.
Drop the shotgun, lady, or I kill the kids.
Sarah quickly turned to see a man with an M4 rifle.
Drop it, lady! We ain't gonna hurt you unless you put up a fight.
You leave my mother alone!
Be still, Michael.
We got you covered, lady. Drop the shotgun and move away from it.
Okay, move away from the kids.
Sarah put her arms around her children.
Move, or they get it.
Now there was a second man in the barn, making himself visible in the loft.
No, please don't.
She surveyed the scene around her. There was the woman and two other men outside the barn, the one who had snuck up behind her, and a fifth person up in the loft. Suddenly, Sarah felt anger wash over her like a wave. She knew that John would not want her to beg these people, and she knew that she wouldn't do it.
Michael, take Annie over there toward the corner. It'll be okay.
She started to edge across the barn floor, keeping the attention of the gunman on her. As she moved, she saw Michael out of the corner of her eye. He was starting to walk toward their bags in the corner. No one was watching him. She also saw a pitchfork in the opposite corner of the barn, perhaps 10 feet away.
All right, lady, on the ground.
What you gonna do, Eddie?
First, I'm going to get me a piece. Then I'll see.
Not in front of her kids, Eddie.
Maybe they'll enjoy it.
All right, Eddie. Me and Al and Pete will go check the house.
I ain't had no head for a while. Maybe we'll get started with that. Stay right there on your knees, lady, or the kids will get it. Now, I'm sure you know what.
Sarah saw the boning knife she'd taken from the house. It was buried up to the handle in the man's right kidney. In the same instant, she saw Michael standing where the man had been a second earlier.
Take Daddy's gun, Mommy!
Sarah picked up the shotgun and drew the Colt 45 and looked toward the loft. The second man was already halfway down the ladder.
Michael, how did you...
Dad said that when he's gone, I'm the man of the family. I'm supposed to protect you and Annie.
Mommy! What the hell did you do, bitch?
Michael, get your sister to the back of the barn. The other two men will be coming very soon.
It's the broad with the kids! Good lady! Stop shooting, we'll burn down the fucking barn! With you and the kids in it! So help me!
It's all right, Michael.
She looked around on the floor of the barn, then walked over to the first man, the one Michael had killed. She reached down and tried to pick up the dead man's military rifle. The sling for the rifle was still over his shoulder, and she had to lift his dead arm to pry the gun loose. She read the legend on the left side of the gun, Colt AR-15. It was like her husband's gun, and definitely better than the shotgun. She moved what she thought was the safety.
Oh, God.
She pushed the magazine back in and searched again for the safety. She found it and pointed the gun in the direction of the floor.
A machine gun?
Sarah remembered having read an article dealing with how some people took sporting rifles and changed them to submachine guns illegally. She guessed that this was one of them. Her husband's gun, the stock was definitely different, fired only one shot at a time.
Put down the gun before you hurt yourself!
Even as she walked back toward the entrance of the barn, Sarah knew what she would do about the two remaining men near the house. There had been others who had drifted by during the night. Outlaws, brigands, just people who wanted to steal. She'd frightened one group away with the shotgun, not even firing it. But she realized these men who had almost killed the children and herself wouldn't be the last. She would have to leave the farm. The pickup truck or the station wagon would only run out of gas. She looked at the two horses in their stalls. Her mind flashed back to the last time she and John had gone riding. She could load the belongings and both children on the horses and still ride herself. She turned toward the house and began to walk toward the half-closed barn doors. She had to get rid of the men at the house before she could do anything else. Several times through the night, when the wind had shifted, she had smelled the gas from the house. The basement had only one window, a small one that somehow hadn't blown out. The basement still had to be full of gas. Both men crouched near the porch.
Keep it up! We're gonna get you anyway, lady!
Mommy, what happened?
I'm a murderer.
I'm a killer.
Mr. President? Mr. President?
Thurston?
Yes, sir. You fell asleep on the couch.
Oh, yes. I guess I did. And it isn't a dream, then, is it?
No, sir. I wish I had better news.
What's the current situation?
Well, we just received word, Mr. President. The Russians are broadcasting on a low-frequency FM band that's getting past all the static. We must formally surrender, or they'll destroy the few remaining cities. I don't know...
Well, what is it, Thurston?
I don't know, sir.
If I surrender, most of the resistance to them will stop. It won't even begin when they land here.
Yes, Mr. President.
If I just let them take us, then they can put any words in my mouth that they want, can't they?
I suppose that's so, sir.
The Vice President, the Speaker of the House, all of my cabinet. Dead?
Yes. Yes, sir.
If I were dead, there would be no United States government to surrender. No one who had the power to surrender, correct?
Well, sir, there were a few members of Congress who were out of Washington. A few may have survived.
But it would take the Russians forever to find them, if they were still alive, right?
Yes, Mr. President.
Do we have a way of getting news out?
We could send out some of the intelligence people to spread the word, I suppose. It would be slow, but once it got started, if the news were important enough, the people would hear it.
That's what I thought. Get me Paul Dorian. After he leaves, I want to see my wife and children. After that, the chief of the Secret Service detail here. Hurry!
All right, Mrs. Richards. I've decided to bring this thing down just south of Albuquerque. There's a lot of flat land out there, and a drop in the desert looks like the best chance we have. I'm betting the Albuquerque airport is finished.
You can't be sure.
You're right. I can overfly it. Now, take hold of the controls. Don't move anything. According to this chart here, Albuquerque should be 10 minutes ahead.
Already, as Rourke looked through the windshield and down toward the ground, the sun was starting to rise. The ground had a gray cast to it. The mountains off to his right were still partially steeped in heavy shadow. He'd driven to Albuquerque many times, through the mountain passes and down. The view had been breathtaking. It still was, he thought, but as he flew low, about a mile from the closest high ridge, he could see that the view had changed. He had no idea if Albuquerque had been hit directly, but there had been a firestorm. He could see that there were few houses standing. The ground was burned black. Some emergency vehicles were moving on the ground below him. There was no sign, no huge crater, to indicate that a direct hit had been made on the city. He found the markers for the airport. A few were still standing. He started to follow them in.
This is Can American 747, flight 601, calling Albuquerque Tower. Do you read me? Over. This is Can American 747, flight 601. Calling Albuquerque Tower. Do you read me? Over. All right, Mrs. Richards, I'm going to fly over the airport and see how it looks. After that, I'll have just enough fuel left to set this thing down there or on the desert. So let's make it a good look.
Oh my God! What happened down there? A missile?
No, I don't think so. I think it's some kind of accident. Probably somebody like us tried to come in and misjudge the runway. Yeah, see over there? Looks like something rammed a fuel truck and they didn't get the fire in time. Firestorm of some kind is what it looks like all over the city there. So the city shouldn't be hot with radioactivity. One way or another, we're not gonna land here.
Rourke banked as gently as he could to get south of what had been the city. The ruins vanished from beneath them and the ground turned into scrub brush and sand. Rourke throttled down again and slowly played the instruments to get the plane's altitude down.
I don't know exactly how low or how slow I can get this thing and still be able to keep airspeed. And if I lose engine power, this thing's gonna fall like a rock. Hit that seatbelt light. Attention everyone, we are heading into our final descent. Assume a crash position. I repeat, assume a crash position.
Rourke scanned the ground. Silently, he prayed that he could have some idea of what he was doing. As far as landing went, there was no similarity between the 747 and military fighter aircraft he had flown before. Bringing this down was like playing Russian roulette with all chambers full. He squinted against the morning sunlight, watching the altimeter, the fuel gauge, and the other instruments.
Okay, Mrs. Richards, I picked out our landing field. Nice flat stretch about 5 miles long with no trees to speak of, back about 25 miles. I'm going around now for a try. We can only do it once. I'm letting us run out of fuel to minimize the risk of fire. One other thing I want you to do. Alert the other stewardesses as soon as we get down to the ground. I want everyone out of here as quickly as possible and as far away from the plane as they can. And I want you in a crash position right by the escape chute in the main cabin. And thank you. You've done great.
Won't you need me to help?
Well, I don't believe two of us can land this thing any better than one. And you've got a cool head. It's going to be needed if anyone's going to survive after we land. Chances are good the cockpit will get the heaviest impact.
You mean you'll be killed, and if I don't stay with you, I'll have a better chance of staying alive.
Yeah, pretty much. Goes back to what we talked about earlier. You've got to opt for life, Mrs. Richards. Anything else is irrational. You don't strike me as an irrational person, and I'd bet that your husband wasn't the kind of guy who'd want you to give up on life.
Are you a psychiatrist too, Mr. Rourke?
Only the bargain basement kind.
I hope you make it, and that your wife and children made it too.
Thank you, Mrs. Richards.
Rourke settled himself back in the captain's seat and tightened the lap and shoulder restraints. He fished in the breast pocket of his jacket for his sunglasses to fight the glare from the sand below him. Slowly, he throttled back, stepping down the 747's altitude. The plane was close to the ground now. It raced away beneath the nose of the big jet. It was as if the airspeed were 100 times faster than the readout on the instrument panel. He throttled back more, nearly stalling the starboard engines, but Rourke held the speed, skimming less than 500 feet above the scrub-dotted desert floor. The 747's nose started to drop, and he brought it up. The starboard engines almost stalled again, and the altimeter needle started dropping.
This is Rourke. Brace for impact. Brace for impact. We're almost down. Stay in the crash position. We're gonna hit.
Rourke looked up. The windshields were cracked, shattered, but still holding up. Trees were all around him. Pine branches virtually covered the front of the fuselage. The port side of the forward cabin was almost completely ripped away. A large tree jutted into the cabin like a can opener. He sat for a moment, regaining his composure.
We need to get the hell out of the plane, but don't panic. Everything is fine.
As they left his office in the Mount Lincoln complex, the president tried to assure his children that they would all be together again. He had tried to tell his wife the truth without letting his children know, but he couldn't find the words. Bobby's face and his wife's were the last faces he saw as his family turned down the corridor. The president turned to Paul Dorian, who was standing in the corridor.
They've landed?
Only in token numbers, Mr. President, and they're pushing the timing on the neutron radiation a little at that. Those cities, like Chicago, are still hot.
Paul, what about the Eden Project? Did it get off?
Without a hitch, sir.
Then maybe there is some hope after all. Send in the chief of my Secret Service detail.
Mr. President, you can't do this.
I have to. If there's going to be any United States left. The United States is not a country, Paul. It's an idea. I finally see that. And if I don't do this, the idea may well die. I don't have much of a choice, do I?
Sir, it's been an honor.
The feeling is mutual, Paul. Now go get Clemmer.
Yes, sir.
Mr. President?
Mike, I've got a favor to ask.
Anything, Mr. President.
Take this envelope.
Yes, sir.
And give me your revolver.
What? But, sir...
That's an order, Mike. There are two letters in the envelope. One is to my wife. The other is to the American people. Thurston Potter knows what to do with them. Give me your gun. I don't know much about guns, Mike. Always wanted to try them, but never had the time. Does yours have a safety catch?
No, sir. Revolvers don't. Mr. President, you can't.
I've got to, Mike.
I can't let you. It's my job to help keep you alive.
If I stay alive, Mike, the Russians will find me and use me. If I die, there will be no government left to capitulate. And free Americans will go on fighting until there is a government again, another elected government that will throw the Soviets out. If they get me, it's all over for all of us.
But, Mr. President, they'll never get into Mount Lincoln.
You know that's not true. And if we're totally cut off, they've got a capitulation anyway. But if the American people know I'm gone, then the Soviets, no matter what they do, can't lie to the American people that the United States has surrendered. It's the only way. Now give me the gun. That's the final order from your commander-in-chief, Mike. Please, forgive me.
Sarah adjusted the tack on her chestnut-colored mare. The white horse with the black mane and tail and four black stockings, John's horse, was already saddled and the gear tied on. She finished adjusting the latigo strap on her own horse. Sarah turned on her heel and took the .45 automatic from the waistband of her blue jeans. The corners of her mouth raised into a smile, and her green eyes lost their hard set. The man she stared at was a familiar one, the retired army sergeant who owned the next farm. He rode a tall Appaloosa gelding. She knew the horse well. On a bay behind him was his wife, Carla, and riding behind her on the same horse was their 10-year-old girl, Millie. Sarah wiped the palms of her hands on the legs of her jeans, then glanced at Michael and Annie standing beside the barn. Carla Jenkins talked too much, and Ron Jenkins didn't talk enough. And their daughter Millie was a brat, Sarah recalled. But she looked at her children again and realized that running into the family was something she should be thankful for.
Ron Jenkins.
My wife and me, we was getting ready to clear out on horseback here, and we heard the explosion over to your place this morning, and I said to Carla, bet you Sarah Rourke's got some problems. John probably ain't home.
I guess you'd call them brigands or something. They wanted to rob us and, well, you know. Thanks for coming to see about us.
You want we should all ride together? I'm taking my wife and daughter up into the mountains. Not far, but should be safer than here. Come with us, Sarah.
I guess there's safety in numbers. Thank you for coming for us. I know it was out of your way. We'll be happy to come with you. I'm sure we can all help each other. I'm almost through here. I just have one thing to do.
I'll help your children get mounted up. On your husband's horse, the white one?
Yes, please. Michael, Annie, come over here. Mr. Jenkins is going to get you all set to go.
Sarah left the group, and taking a pencil and a sheet of paper from a pad she'd packed, she left a message for her husband.
My dearest John, you were right. I don't know if you're still alive. I'm telling myself and the children that you survived. We're fine. The chickens died overnight, but I don't think it was radiation. No one is sick. The Jenkins family came by and we're headed into the mountains with them. I know you'll come to find us once you get back to the retreat. I'm telling myself that you will find us. Maybe it will take a long time, but we won't give up hope. Don't you. The children love you. Annie has been good. Michael is more of a little man than we'd thought. Some thieves came by and Michael saved my life. We weren't hurt. Hurry. Always, Sarah.
She took one last look at the note.
I love you, John.
Sarah slipped her note inside a plastic sandwich bag from Michael's lunch the last day he'd been in school. There was a nail already driven into the side of the barn door, and she stuck the plastic bag over it. Snatching up her black canvas purse, she turned on her heel and ran toward her horse.
You ready?
Sarah Rourke looked at the Jenkinses, then at her children, then pressed her heels gently against her horse's flanks. She held the reins from John's horse, which carried Michael and Anne, in her left hand. As they started from the yard, she looked back. The ruins of the house were still smoking, but her attention focused on the barn door, the note to her husband, nailed to the inside. Silently, she prayed that he was alive to read it.
Come on, Tildy.
I want to thank all of you for volunteering. I estimate we'll be
Mr.
back
Rourke!
Here.
Mr. Rourke! I thought you all might like some coffee before you start out.
Yeah, thanks. I thought we only got friendly service in the skies.
I can't believe the way you were able to get everybody out, Mr. Rourke, then go back for the things in the cargo hold. You're a real live hero.
Well, going back into the cargo hold was pure selfishness. I needed the stuff I had there.
Those guns?
Yeah, and the other ones too. I'm going to have to go into town for some medical help if I can find it. There isn't much more I can do for most of the people who were injured. And when I leave you people, you may need to defend yourselves. And I need to defend myself when I try making it into Albuquerque.
Defend ourselves? From what? Surely no one is going to want to hurt us.
Let me ask you a question. Would you have felt comfortable walking around in a high-crime area in Atlanta last night? Or any night?
Well, no.
How about Chicago? New York? Los Angeles?
Well, certainly I wouldn't have.
Now, that's with a functioning police force, civil courts, the whole shot of civilization. What about with no police, no courts, no laws, no civilization?
But...
People who'd hit you over the head to steal your money when there might be a cop looking will kill you to steal your food or your medical supplies, your ammunition, when their lives depend on getting it. You understand? Since last night, in almost any area you can think of, there is no law, no protection. The only recourse you have is yourself or someone who cares enough about you to put himself on the line.
Is that why you're going for help, Mr. Rourke?
Somebody has to. I'm going to leave you in charge with a gun. That Canadian businessman who was sitting next to me, what's his name?
Mr. Quentin?
Yeah, well, he said that he shoots. I'll leave him a gun too, two of them. If somebody shows up and starts acting funny, you shoot first and ask questions afterward. You got it? I'm taking these five men with me just in case we can't get help to come out here. A half dozen of us will be able to bring enough stuff back to do something. I make it 20, maybe 25 miles into Albuquerque. We'll be there by dawn. We'll be back by tomorrow night, late probably. So just hold out, huh?
Mr. Rourke, I didn't just bring you coffee. I thought you and the other men could use these.
Sandwiches?
Uh-huh.
Very thoughtful, Mrs. Rich.
It's Mandy, please.
You have a pretty smile, Mandy. Hopefully I'll get to see it again. Let's go.